Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, everyone. My name is Eva Matza. I'm an author. I've written Sex Lies in Stellenbosch, Sex Lies Declassified, and Sex Lies and Alibis, as well as Christine. I'm very excited on this very auspicious day. It's World Book Day.
I didn't realize that.
Lindsay.
Thank you so much.
Lindsay Normand has written Khaki Fever. It's just been launched, and I'm very excited to be with you this morning.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Lindsay, instead of me doing the whole thing.
So I've been in publishing for about 35 years and working as an editor. Well, firstly as a proofreader, then an editor, also as a writer. It's really been a long publishing journey. I originally started in printing when I was about 20, I think, and then just worked my way through. And now I'm mainly focused on educational publishing.
You started a business, Wordwise.
Wordwise Online. Yes, I started it with colleagues of mine, Barbara and Wendy. And we've all worked in the publishing industry for such a long time that we decided that it would be great to share our skills. So we developed an online proofreading program. And we took about 2 years to develop it. We thought it would take us about 6 months or so, but it ended up being a huge task. But it was really, really exciting, and we're so pleased with the product. So it's basically you can register, and then you can it's about a 6 month course that you do to become a proofreader.
That's brilliant. Very exciting. I also heard via the via that you are a children's author.
Yes.
As well. So this is not your first foray into publishing, really.
No.
Okay, tell us about your children's books.
So the children's books, I work with a partner. We have a very small NGO that operates in Matabele land in Zimbabwe. And we run teacher training workshops, and we donate books, and we help out with the clinics, donate baby clothes and things like that. And what I realized while training teachers is that the children don't have any books up there that where they can relate to their own context. So they will have lots of donated books where, you know, it will be about Cinderella and Hansel and Gretel, princess type stories. So I decided to write stories that where they can relate to themselves and they can actually see themselves in their own context. So I wrote The Elephants Are Coming, and I also wrote Aunt Alice and the Lion. And then after I had self-published them, I actually dropped them off at Penguin, and they picked them up and published them.
That's amazing. And then there's also an activity book as well.
Yes, that's right. So that's Temba's Safari Activity Book, and that was really great fun to write. I actually found the notes of that the other day, and I was just remembering how much fun it was.
Is that kind of sold to game lodges in that?
Yes, I think so. Also sort of mainstream bookshops, and I think a lot of airport shops as well.
That's divine.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've taken us out of the urban landscape and into the bush. Tell us a bit about your background. Do you have a background as far as game ranging and nature and the bush
yes,
is concerned?
Yes, very much so.
So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so the first holiday that I had in the bush was with my mum and dad in the Kruger National Park. My dad was absolutely passionate about the Kruger. He had been there a lot during his childhood, and I think I was about 14 with our first trip, and my sister and I just also fell totally in love with the bush, and we started going to the Kruger a lot. And then I suppose in my 20s, I started going to Zimbabwe, and that's really mainly been my bush experience, although I do go to the Kruger National Park every year. I'm just actually about to go in May now. But Zimbabwe, that's where I first sort of had the idea for the NGO. I stayed at a place called the Bamani Tented Camp, and I met the owner of Mvelo Safari Lodges, Mark Butcher, and he showed me the schools that were surrounding the lodges on the border of the national park, the Hwange National Park. And so, you know, apart from wanting to help the very impoverished schools in the areas, I also just fell in love with that particular part of Zimbabwe. It's absolutely beautiful. And, yeah, whenever I can, I would, you know, I go to the bush, and that is my absolute best kind of holiday. I think if I didn't travel to Europe again ever in my life, I would be quite happy if I could just spend every holiday in the bush. It really just is so magical.
It is magical, I must say. What I do love about your book is that it's a wonderful blend of comedy. There's a little bit of love interest. How would you place it if you were selling this book? Where would you place it in terms of genre?
I think it's quite a difficult genre to classify because it's a romance, but there's no sort of spice or steam. I was saying to someone the other day that the characters that fall in love, you know, really at the end, they do end up in bed together, but they actually end up under the bed, not in the bed, during a thunderstorm. And so, yeah, I think it's a drama, it's an adventure, it's a comedy. I suppose I would just say it's a funny story, maybe.
It's really a fun read, and it is a page-turner, and it's something that you can just perhaps buy at an airport as well.
Yes.
Get onto a plane.
Exactly.
I mean, I am so fearful of flying, so the first thing I do is buy a book, but an easy-to-read book,
yes,
that I can just kind of like immerse myself into the page. When I say easy-to-read, I'm saying something that I'm not going to have to worry about, oh my goodness, where was I, and go back. Just
exactly.
Actually really immerse yourself in the story, and the flight is 2 hours to Johannesburg, thunderstorms and all.
Yes,
so
I'm exactly like that as well.
So it was a book that I really, really enjoyed reading. I wouldn't mind you just for the listeners for you to just read the first few pages, because that really draws you into the book.
Yes,
and also
of course.
You know, I really chortled out loud because I have been on safari and I have sat with those kind of people, and I have looked at the game rangers and the guides, and thought, shame, these poor people, they really do have to deal with a lot.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind,
of course,
Lindsay,
yes,
you can read for us. Thanks.
Undaunted, their reaction was like totally normal. I continued, "Let's talk about a few safety instructions. Hopefully we will see lion today, but if we do, please remain seated and keep still. The reason for this is that we don't want to break our silhouette. Keep very quiet when we approach game. Blah, blah, blah. I could see I was boring the pants off them, and frankly, I was boring myself too. Magnus, I noticed out of the corner of my eye, had his group enthralled. He had one hand on the bonnet of his Land Cruiser, all the better to display the muscles in his manly arm, and was casually leaning on his rifle with the other, luckily pointing it to the ground, because how he got his license I do not know. Every now and again they broke into little gusts of laughter as he rolled out his practiced quips. Right, if you're ready, you can hop on board and we'll start our drive. After they got in, I remembered that I had to ask them their names, and it was a bit awkward as they could see it was an afterthought. The women in their 20s were Mandy and Candace from America, then David and Joanne from Australia, and finally Inge and Jürgen from Germany. I can almost immediately see who's going to cause problems on a game drive, and in this case it was David. It turned out David was a South African who had immigrated to Australia in the 1990s and was clearly feeling pissed off about that. He was also a bit of a know-it-all and already telling some unlikely stories about his trips to the Kruger Park when he lived in Johannesburg. The Kruger Park is much bigger than this place and much more authentic, he said. Probably about 100 or maybe 1,000 times bigger, and there are no separate encampments for the animals. It's a pity you can't all go there instead. We're going to the Serengeti next week, said Candace. In Tanzania, right? Never heard of it, said David. If you get on it right away, you might still be able to hire a car and get a rendezvous in the Kruger. I made a mental note to reassure Candace and Mandy about the Serengeti and to tell them that it would be nothing like this godforsaken excuse for a reserve. The plains is about a 2-hour drive from Cape Town, making it ideal for tourists looking for one-day excursions and what we call a Ferrari safari. On arrival, they get a dodgy buffet lunch, and then they are loaded up and taken to see the animals. The plains is not big enough for the big game to roam freely, so we drive them in and out of encampments and try to pretend they're very lucky to see so much game.
Okay, can we stop there, Lindsay? I want to carry on. So just hold that space. But
yes,
I wanted to talk about the Ferrari safari, because
yes,
that is quite funny. just tell us, for those of us who don't know what a Ferrari safari is, I mean, they're quite... there are quite a few of them, particularly outside.
Yes.
A short distance from Cape Town. So
yeah,
people think that they've done the real thing, but not really.
No, not okay, really. And I think, yeah, I mean, always the red flag is when there are animals in encampments. Then you know that it's not authentic, obviously. And sometimes there's a reason for it. But Yeah, Ferrari Safari is really, I suppose, where you just, you know, you get picked up and zoomed off to the game reserve and you are fed and watered, and then you jump into the game vehicle and you zoom off and you see, you know, various animals.
And you should have seen those.
You should have seen them.
There's no like tracking or anything that's done.
No.
I mean, it does serve its purpose.
It does.
If you've got international visitors that don't have a chance or time to go to the Kruger Park, that's exactly where you go. And there is that sense of.
Yeah, it does have its place, but it's not authentic. And in fact, I was in Namibia a couple of years ago and I was on a business trip and I was desperate just to go on like a day safari or something. And so I really thought I'd chosen the lodge really carefully. And we set off and it was a 2-hour drive there and it was really beautiful. And they loaded us up into the cruiser and we went off and the gate sort of opened and there was this leopard and the tourists that were there were just oohing and aahing. And so I said to them, well, is this leopard injured? Did you rescue it? So they said no. And said, well, when did you get it then? And why is it in an encampment? They said, no, they bought it as a cub. So I sort of sat there and I just got really, really angry. And then he threw it a neck of some animal and the leopard started eating it. And then it started choking.
Oh.
And it sort of ran off into the corner and it was, you know, it was clearly not, it was not really able to swallow it very well. So by this stage, I just had enough. So I said to the guide, you know, this is really not on. And can you please take me back to the lodge because I don't want to carry on. I said, are all the other animals in the encampments? And he said, yes. So it was quite awkward. There was a very awkward silence. And then I decided to lecture the the people in the cruiser, and I said, you know, you shouldn't really support lodges where they buy animals, and especially a baby, because you know this baby was taken from its mother. It's not ethical. And then I got back to the lodge, and then I went to the owner, and I said, you know, by the way, your leopard is choking, and I think you should go and sort it out. And so off I went in a big huff.
But why do you think it was choking? Just as a matter of interest,
I think it probably tried to eat. I think it was an esophagus or something like that. And I'm sure it was fine, but it hadn't killed the animal, and so it was hungry. So it an animal when they're on a kill, I don't think they start with the esophagus.
Yeah.
You know, so they start with the contents of the stomach,
And then move their way,
to the meat. Yeah. So. Yeah, I just, you know, it's all part of being in an unnatural environment and being unnaturally fed that things like that can happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
So back to the story.
Yes.
Let's continue because that's another thing. We're talking about the guests now. You've got some interesting guests on that little drive that you've introduced, which I find quite funny because it sets the scene to the actual story and Alex, how she actually cannot contain herself.
Yeah.
Or stop herself. Would you like to just continue?
Yes,
I just absolutely. Particularly to that one part with the buck.
Some guests stay overnight in the lodge, which was what my guests were going to do, and I was already dreading having to make polite conversation over dinner. As we entered the first encampment, there was no sign of Magnus. He usually did the first one at speed, since he found the antelope and bovids boring, preferring instead to head straight to the second one where the lions are kept. Of course, the first antelope we saw were a herd of impala. I stopped and turned off the engine and began. Here we have impala, said David, and they're rutting, which means they want sex. Well, no, not exactly, I said. The rutting period is from April to June, but you're right that rutting is when they engage in sexual activity. This is a mixed herd of females and males, and you can tell the difference because the rams have horns and the ewes don't. I've seen a lady impala with horns, said David. That's not possible, I said as politely as I could, because I was already getting a bit irritated with him. Females don't have horns. I started up the engine again, and in the mirror I saw him turn around and roll his eyes at the others. Other than making lewd remarks about the size of the buffalo's balls and telling a stupid joke about a zebra, he kept quiet, and I began to hope that he wasn't as bad as I thought.
Okay. So we're talking about, this is an introduction to Alex.
Yes.
Or Alexandra.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about that protagonist? Because I found her quite layered, particularly yes. as you go on, you see that there's a lot more to her than meets the eye. Just tell us what inspired you. Were you inspired by one person in particular or?
No, not really. I think, you know, I started the story just with this first chapter and I didn't have a very clear idea of where it was going to go, but I did have a very clear idea about the character. So I wanted someone who was a bit irritable, who didn't really like people, didn't suffer fools, and was caught in a sort of a catch-22 situation where she loves her job as a guide and she's actually an extremely good guide, but she's caught in a situation where as a guide she has to deal with people as well, and that's not something that she can do. And there's a background to that is why she is so she's feisty and very prickly, and yeah, she doesn't actually have many people skills. So she tends to get herself into situations where she just makes them worse because she says the wrong thing and she's quite blunt. And she also tends to tell the truth as she sees it and gets herself into tricky situations and indeed offends people.
There's an impulsivity to her.
Absolutely, yes.
I actually recognize that in my one daughter. Where it just all comes out.
Yes, there's no filter.
There's no filter.
Yes,
and
yes.
But that's so endearing because
yes.
the truth is told and
she doesn't mean to be
she
rude.
She doesn't mean to be rude. No. It just is what it is.
It just
so that's,
comes out.
It's quite relatable because I think there are quite a yeah. few characters, people that are walking amongst us that actually cannot hold back.
Yes.
But she does know what she's doing. How old would you say Alex is?
So I thought I would sort of put her probably in her, when I wrote her, I thought she would probably be in her late 20s, maybe 26, around about there.
Yeah, I saw it as
yeah.
about that.
Yeah, age. she has an older sister who I'd sort of put it about in her, like nearly 30, and then she's got twin brothers, and they're sort of, I would have said they were like 32, round about there.
So your cast of characters is also quite quite colourful. You've got the brothers, and they were models.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes.
So they've come back.
Bad boys.
Bad boys.
Yeah.
But they've come back to open up the paddle courts,
yes.
which is quite funny as well, because
yeah.
they're completely different to Alex. In
yes.
fact, the siblings seem to be. And then you've got Gillian. Who's married? Am
yes.
I right? Is her name Gillian?
Jessica.
Jessica.
Yes.
Jessica.
Yes. Yeah.
Who's married? And yeah, so she's a little bit older,
and she's got horrible Roger as her
and she's
husband.
Got Roger.
Yeah.
Two absent parents.
Yes.
And her nanny who basically raised her.
Yeah.
And they're kind of like drawn in, not so much the twin. The brothers, are they twins?
Yes, yes.
Not so much the brothers, but
yeah.
definitely the sister definitely makes her way in, as does Lisbeth, the mom, who
the
she
mom.
Doesn't call mum. She
yeah.
calls her Lisbeth.
Yeah.
And the father, Edward.
The dad. Yeah.
Very privileged background.
Yes.
So she decides she's going to work at this the Plains, which is basically the Ferrari Safari.
Yes.
Tell us some more about your other characters, which are quite... definitely placed in South Africa, that's for sure. You
yes.
can almost hear their voices, which is lovely. You know who they are. You definitely, if you're South African, you can definitely
you know,
identify
yeah.
immediately with them.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the people in the
at the lodge.
At the Plains.
Yeah. At the Plains. So okay, the Plains is owned by a couple called Barent and Antoinette. And Antoinette, she absolutely adores her husband, but she doesn't really enjoy the Plains at all. She's not really that, you know, big into wildlife, and so she's very manicured, beautifully turned out, and she's quite streng, so she doesn't take any nonsense. Whereas Barent is a big softie, and he can't bear it when anybody gets fired, or you know, if Antoinette sort of gets cross with anyone, he kind of slinks away and gets really upset. And he adores the Plains. That's his big dream come true. And then the owner of the second lodge is a guy called Len Fletcher, and everybody calls him Legend because he's a very, very good tracker and a guide. But Legend is really drinks like a fish, and he's often found behind the bar in his clothes after a heavy night of drinking. He's got dreadlocks. He's got a big, he's got a scar on his face, probably from a fight or an encounter with an animal. His nose has been broken a few times.
He's really the camel man, really.
Yes,
think
he's
about
exactly
him.
The camel man.
if you were brought up in my era, you'd understand what I mean.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So he's got a very, very short fuse, but he's really funny, and his language is bad. A lot of swearing from legend, and he's got a girlfriend, Bianca, who is a real typical mean girl.
But she's definitely the most unlikely person you'd expect.
to be in a game lodge.
To be hooked up
with legend.
Him. Yeah, with
yes,
legend.
Yes. Yes.
And she does like to assert herself.
Absolutely.
Definitely. So she's also like the
baddie.
I think.
She was a lovely character to write because she just, it was great fun making her really, really mean. I mean, her comments and everything were really wonderful to write. And then there's Mariki, who's really funny. Mariki, she does a lot of code switching between English and Afrikaans, and she's also has a great turn of phrase. She's in love with Pietrus, who's one of the guides. And then there is Corneli, who is incredibly good-looking. He's kind of GQ material guide. He's a strong, silent type, and Alex has a hero crush on Corneli.
Because she's looked at, looked at YouTube videos.
Yes, she's seen him on YouTube before. She saw him having a standoff with an elephant when he was guiding a group of people, and he just stood his ground and shouted and waved, and he wasn't fazed at all, and the elephant retreated. And so she just has this big hero crush on Corneli, and he's the head guide, and he's the person that he's responsible for her training.
As far as Mariki's concerned, I quite liked her character because Alex hasn't got many friends. She's got one friend called Saskia that she made at school.
Yeah.
And Saskia has committed to trying her responses. So that I'm not going to give too much away, but they have formed something. It's like a little safety net that she's helped set up. But they both need it. But I think older Alex is using it a little bit more than Saskia.
Yes,
and she meets this Mariki, who she almost sees that there's a potential for a girl friendship to form.
Yes,
and She will go to all lengths to kind of make sure that she doesn't damage that opportunity.
Yes.
You can see. So it almost alludes to trying to make up for what happened while she was growing up. She definitely wants to make sure that she kind of forges a good friendship, and she does with Mariki.
Yeah, because she goes to the second game lodge wanting to make a fresh start. And so I wanted to portray Mariki as someone who is just one of those really friendly people who you sort of bowled over by. So they don't sort of see, any barriers to friendship. They just want to be friendly with everybody. And so I think she's a little bit bowled over by Mariki in a good way. And see someone who's just really kind to the core.
And she is. And you can almost see that perhaps you have spent time in a lodge with people that were working in that lodge, because you can see that allegiances and alliances have been formed, and there's always that one person that will always be a throw a spanner in the works, and that would be Dirk. So you can hear their characters, you can almost see their faces, so that's what's so lovely about it, is that you don't, not much description is really needed. Because a lot of the time it comes across in the dialogue.
In the dialogue, yeah.
And I love dialogue.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I absolutely love it. I find it so much fun to write. And in fact, I had to go back and put in a lot of description because I was just, when I was writing, I was sort of galloping through it. And so I actually forgot to even describe Yamhila, the fictional game reserve, and so there were lots of gaps where I suddenly thought, I'm not actually saying I'm not describing the scenery enough. So I do that, but I don't waste too much on it. I try and be quite succinct about that.
So tell me, let's talk about that, because that's quite difficult. You've come in from an editor's role and a proofreader's role, yes, and then you're writing. Was that a challenge?
It wasn't really. You know, I've done a lot of overwriting in the past, and I think what I did and what they say writers shouldn't do is that I would write something and then I would go back the next evening and I would edit it and proofread it. And so I ended up with, you know, sort of I kept on continually editing and proofreading as I went along, and I just couldn't help that because just being a trained editor and proofreader, that sort of came naturally. Mm. So I know that a lot of people writing will say, just sit down and write it and then see what you've got at the end of the process. But that was totally impossible for me. And I'm actually glad that I did do it, because it actually helped me in the writing process. It clarified a lot of things for me.
I don't think there's any method that's one method that's right or wrong. I think it's something that works for you. You don't really plan, do you? You just you alluded to this in the beginning that you just started off with this the first few pages, yes, and didn't know where it was going to go.
Yeah.
Is that basically the way you write?
It is. But what I did was about halfway through, I got a little bit stuck. So once she'd arrived at the second lodge, and I sort of thought, well, now what? So what I did, I got a yearly planner, you know, one of those ones where it's a double page spread for a month. And then for every day, I sort of plotted out the chapter, just made notes about what would happen in the timeline. And I actually used the calendar as well. So then she arrived on a Monday, and this happened on the Friday, and that happened on the Tuesday. So I kept track of that. And then I kept track of the story that way and planned it. And then I also used whole pages for each chapter as well, where I fleshed them out. So those year planners were really helpful.
But I think I have the same way of writing as you do. I just cannot sit down and plot the entire story.
No,
you have an idea, And then you just go with it and you see where it's going to take you, which, yes, is quite exciting. But it also, I think, must be quite just from what I've spoken to other people that have planned, they know exactly, you know, they've planned it so well that I think maybe it cuts a lot of the time that's wasted.
Absolutely.
I don't know. How long did it take you to write Khaki Fever?
So it took about, I'd say about 10 or 11 months, but that wasn't writing full time. So I've been working full time. So I would typically start writing, you know, at about 5:30 in the evening and then finish around about 9:00. But I didn't write every night, and then I would also write on the weekends. But yeah, what you're saying is, you know, is very true. I wish that I had gone in knowing the whole story, but in a way, you know, it's also better that I didn't, because it kind of, ideas came as I wrote.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think it's such a creative process, it's a lot of fun.
It's fluid.
Yeah.
You know, so then unexpected things happen, and then you know, you write out. Then that's also, I think, a good thing about reading what you've written, because I would go back and I would read the whole book from beginning to where I'd got up to, just to kind of get myself in the vibe of the whole thing. And then I think, oh, wait, this can happen, that can happen. And also, you know, if you hear funny phrases or you hear funny incidents, you can work that into your manuscript as well. And that's something that's constantly happening in your life and constantly changing. So I did a lot of that.
And I think also your characters start coming forward.
Yes.
Characters that you haven't actually even thought about.
Exactly.
They just appear as a story moves on. So that's also a very exciting process. Well, I find it exciting. I'm sure it must be very nice to have sat down, and I think that takes a lot of time to actually plan. But sometimes I would imagine, I'm sure you are a little bit, you're not going to be fixed completely, but I think it's harder to change when you've when you've actually got this, okay, this is how it's going to be. Yes. And you have an idea, more or less, how it's going to absolutely. End, I think, especially as it goes on, as the story goes on. So, it's very similar. Was there one specific thing that actually made you decide this is the story? Was there a specific incident or...?
No, not really. I suppose I mean, the first sort of idea for the story was thinking, what if there was a girl who wanted a job at a fancy game lodge, and she felt that as a girl she didn't stand a chance, so then she pretended to be a guy. And that's what Alex does in her application. So that was actually going to be the big part of the story, but it ended up being a very minor part of the story.
That's basically how she got the job, really.
Yeah. But, well, she thinks it is, but it wasn't. So they had kind of suspected that she was doing that anyway. Mm. So it became a very small part of the story. And then it just sort of, I suppose it evolved. You know, I just kept on thinking of funny things that had happened on game drives or while I was staying at game lodges. And then, it does, in a way, take on a life of its own, because I just found myself just merrily going along with it and writing bits, and then I would write bits of the end and bits of the middle and then link them all up. So at some stage it was all over the show, but that was actually quite nice.
Mm. Just to try and actually weave it all back in.
Yeah, and the ending as well. I was going to end it in a certain way, and then I ended it in a completely different way, which was also really nice.
Okay, so just tell us about, have you had any book launches, in-store book launches?
I haven't had in-store book launches yet, but I did have one at my house, and I decided to go all out, and it was great fun. I hired a mannequin. he was dressed up in a khaki uniform. His name was Paul, and he was freaked me out completely because he arrived on the Thursday night. And the
was
launch
Paul
was,
Cornelli?
I think he was meant to be Legend.
Oh,
But I don't know who he was in the end, but he was awful, and because he was enormous. And so the guys arrived with him, and they put him down in an armchair. And then every time I came across him, I just screamed. And then...
Did you take pictures? I mean, this is such a wonderful marketing opportunity.
He was dreadful. And then the guys that delivered him said, you know, you must give him a beer. And I said, sure, and everything. And then... And then I have a Malawian family that live at my house, and they walked past the kitchen door and they saw Paul sitting in the kitchen in the armchair. So they nearly had a heart attack. And eventually we all carried Paul into the spare room, and I even locked the door because I just had this. It's good having an imagination, but sometimes it's not a good thing.
Especially when you're living alone.
I kept on thinking, imagine if Paul like suddenly reaches out his arm and touches me or something.
So
Paul was there, and then I had Barron's Bush Pub. I hired a little tiki bar, and we had brandy and coke and shots, and it was just such good fun. So I just invited friends and family, and Mike Nichol chatted to me, and because I'd actually written a book on Mike Nichol's masterclass.
I also did Mike Nichol's masterclass.
But
he
did
helped
you
me with Christine? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So he chatted to me, and you know, he's so funny. He really is. He's lovely. I was very nervous, but we actually had such a lovely conversation.
I am just going to wish you all the best, and I think it's so exciting. It's your first Bubba,
yes.
Your first debut novel, and that is very exciting. And mazel tov.
Thank you so much.
On this World Book Day to be speaking to you, and I hope you are a bestseller.
Thank you,
Eva. It was wonderful
Eva.
Meeting you, Lindsay.
And it was lovely to meet you, too.
You.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.